What you're about to listen to may include some potty talk. Then again, it may not. I hope it does, though. It's Wednesday, September 26, 2018. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Washington Post headline from today: Trump's attacks on Kavanaugh's second accuser show why the GOP hired a woman to question Ford. So the news is, the news that this is commenting on, is that Senate Republicans have found a capable, experienced, sharp prosecutor to question Christine Blasey Ford at their hearing tomorrow. Though sharp and capable weren't the first adjectives Mitch McConnell reached for.
We have hired a female assistant to go on staff and to ask these questions in a respectful and professional way.
Well, of course they hired a woman, and there is no shame in that, especially if they pay her more than $376 for her day's work. Why $376? Well, a senator's salary is $174,000, so per day, that's $476, and 79% of that, in other words, 79 cents on the man's dollar, would be $376. So if this woman is getting paid any more than $376, she's doing better than she could expect to from the male Republicans in the Senate. But the Post headline did tickle me about Trump's attacks on Kavanaugh's second accuser. And he has said of her, she's messy, she's nothing, she's part of a con, a C-O-N con. Trump attacking an accuser. That is what the GOP needed to figure out to hire a woman to question Blasey Ford. Okay. Donald Trump engaged in this round of vitriolic smears because he is an undisciplined, cruel, excessive, vengeful, dishonest bully of a man. Now, I guess you could look at all those traits and say, well, there's your problem right there, that he is a man. The man part is what we need to avoid in questioning Christine Blasey Ford. It is true that the optics of an all-male panel questioning Dr. Christine Blasey Ford would seem off to a lot of people. Yes, the optics would. But, you know, with Trump, you get optics, you get audibles, you get graphic, full-on sensory assault. My point isn't that the Post was chalking up Trump's horrible excess to his gender. It was more like, I don't even think Republicans in the Senate really need to turn to Trump as the useful poster child. He's really more of an actual child. They don't really need to reach to Trump to learn their lesson. Just as Trump learns no lessons, he pretty much imparts none. He is a black hole. I think anyone this side of Alex Jones would know not to take the tone and tack that Donald Trump took with in questioning the second accuser. And even such forward-thinking, youthful male allies to the feminist cause like Mitch McConnell and Chuck Grassley, even they don't need to be told that. On the show today, well, it's not the second accuser, it's the third that we now have to contend with, and that'll be the spiel. But first, director Nicole Holofcener, in such movies as Lovely and Amazing, is known for her funny, insightful portrayals of female leads and the somewhat self-deluded but maybe kind of charming doofus guys who torment these women. But now, she's out with a new Netflix film. It's called Land of Steady Habits, and she finally has a male protagonist. But don't worry, he is a doofus, and he does have kind of a low-grade tormenting thing going on. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay, the neighbor, and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we gvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures the Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further, the Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. Nicole Holof Center is out with a new movie. Now, we put the possible name of the movie, it's called The Land of Steady Habits, but we put it through the Holof Center name generator, and we thought it might be Walking with Friends or Enough Talking or Please and Lovely or Friends Give Money, but it's not any of those. It is The Land of Steady Habits, which, do you know this? That is the quasi-unofficial state motto of Connecticut. The other motto is the Nutmeg State. I've seen the movie, Land of Steady Habits, much better title. Hello, Nicole, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure, thank you.
So I couldn't help notice there's a guy right there in the middle of the movie.
Really?
Yeah, it's male-centered.
Yeah, that Ben Mendelsohn.
That guy's good.
He's amazing.
But for your last four movies... Five movies. Mm-hmm. Gandolfini co-starred in Enough Said, for sure, mm-hmm. with Julia Louis-Dreyfus. But this is the one where, if you had to say protagonist, it would be a man. Was that, I know this is adapted from a book and he's the main character, something you wanted to do or something you just fell into?
Kind of both. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wasn't actively seeking a script about it with a male lead, but I read this book and I loved it and it had a male lead. And I thought, oh, good, that's okay.
So is that how it came out? You read the book and said, hey, can we option this for a movie?
Well, yes, except that my agent sent it to me. He's, you know, and, you know, they send me books and stuff. And I said, I like this one.
Yeah.
And so we shopped it around and got it, you know, paid to develop it and then financed.
That whole thing.
Yeah.
Do you like adapting? Because I know you work on other screenplays. But when you direct a movie, how is adapting against writing your own thing in terms of feeling that you have full authorship and ownership of it?
Mm-hmm. I think I've only done it once this time. So I don't know. I think I forgot that I didn't write at all. And I basically knew the answers to the questions.
Right.
As if I'd written it, I became in love with the material. And, you know, I changed the book a lot and took a lot of things out of it. So there's some very much me things in there. Is that a terrible sentence? But you know what I mean. There's very much me there, and I am
me
a writer.
Much a lot in.
Yeah.
Yeah, me.
And I make a living
Nicole
as a
there.
Writer.
See, look.
Yeah.
My favorite bit of dialogue in the movie, and this is why I was looking for the book, the main character is talking to his friend in a bar, and he's talking about the webs of connectiveness.
I used to have this vision of my life was like a web, and these threads that connected me, you know?
Yeah.
And the more webs you could have coming from you, then the more important you were, right? Like, so if you're a doctor, you cure a bunch of
patients.
Then, or a teacher, you got a million threads, you know? And you would be basically irreplaceable, right? Because so many people depended on you, right? You understand what I'm saying?
It's webs.
Yeah, but it's really not the case.
Come on.
No. It's the web, the web.
So was that you? Was that your?
No.
That's him.
It's actually in the book, and it wasn't the Anders line. Ben, it wasn't in the script, and Ben read the book over and over, and he said, Charlie, the young kid, has this line, which you imagine once you've seen the movie that it makes sense that he would also say that.
Yes.
But we didn't have the place for him to say that, and Ben said, can I say these lines? And I said, great. And we worked on, you know, how to work it into the script.
So this is why I was fascinated with it. You could score that differently and maybe shoot it differently and give a different feeling and try to convince the audience that this is a true profundity coming from someone who's lived life. Or you could hold it out there that maybe this guy is being a bit of a grandiose blowhard in the moment. And I wasn't exactly sure what you were going for, and I think maybe you were going for either a little bit of both, or it's okay to have that ambiguity, because he is saying something that seems profound, but it's also something that's very, you know, tragic and self-congratulatory.
I can't say I agree with that. I felt that, really, he felt that webs were being created without him. Life was going on without him. And they were doing just fine. So in that respect, yes, he's a narcissist, you know.
Yes.
Because life goes on.
Also, Josh Pace, is that how you say his last name? Who's been in, like, a lot of your movies,
yeah,
too. Great actor. he's rolling his eyes,
yeah.
And it comes right after he was hit up for money. I got the sense that it was, because it was in a bar, it was a little bit of this kind of therapeutic talk. It goes to advance the character. He is narcissistic and thinking about life. But I also think, again, it's a self-serving. People say things for a reason, and the reason that mostly we say things is because we want some good reaction. We want some good stimuli from the world around us. So I think there is truth in it, but also advances the character as, you know, he's a little bit of a preening narcissist looking for a pat on the back, like good insight.
Huh. I thought he was just needing a friend.
Mm-hmm. So you thought him more vulnerable, yeah.
Yeah, more yeah. vulnerable. I feel but look, you know, you're the one who watched it, so.
Oh, come on.
What?
I could get it wrong. I could get
true.
It totally wrong.
Or everybody has their own perspective, really.
Yeah.
But no, I thought he was feeling pretty sad and shut out, and he knows this guy, and he knows he has the money to lend him, and they've probably never shared intimate thoughts.
Yes.
And, you know, the other guy's like, what are you talking about? Just drink up. Let's
right.
go to a strip club.
Right.
And that's in the book, you know,
yeah.
that character. More than what you're saying, pat on the back. I think he really just wants someone to share his unhappiness with.
This movie shows me that you like and understand men. You're pretty kind and forgiving to men.
I like men.
Yeah. It's clear that you like men.
Oh, that's good.
I don't think that that wasn't true in the early movies. In fact, it definitely was. You gave grace notes to characters who in a lot of movies would just be a punchline.
Mm-hmm.
But you have sons.
Yes.
Is that right? How many sons?
And they're men.
Yeah.
They just turned 21.
Uh-huh.
I have twin boys. That's it.
Did the fact that, I think the characters, the adult sons in this movie are a little older than that, but did that attract you to it?
Unconsciously,
yeah.
I'm sure it did. I mean, I have my terrors and fears as a mother, and, you know, this movie certainly explores that. Again, not consciously. I thought, you know, when I was shooting it and my sons were on the set visiting, I was much more aware of some of the dialogue that was, you know, in the book or that I'd written that did reflect my experience raising sons.
Yeah, and I think all your characters, but as a man, I was either looking at it unconsciously or just thinking about it. But in Walking and Talking, I got the sense that the characters, and you were writing from the perspective of someone in her 20s, you're like, what is with men? What is with these men? I'm trying to figure them out. They're a complexity and oftentimes a gigantic headache. But now it's more from the perspective of a parent or a mother, where it's not so much a mystery as it is a source of a different kind of emotion, a worry and a consternation.
Right.
So
right.
the relationship to these kind of could be troublesome man boys has changed over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe mellowed. I don't know.
I don't know. I think that there's probably so many movies that are similar to Walking and Talking of women in their 20s trying to figure shit out.
Yeah.
You know, it seems, and again, not on purpose, that I keep writing about whatever is happening in my life as I get older. I would like that to change. I don't have to do this. And I would love to go back and write about young people.
Yeah.
Or a bunch of men or a different genre. And, you know, this one, yeah, it's definitely and also Enough Said was a lot about parenting, but also about finding a mate.
Yeah.
So, you know, those things are so prevalent in my life.
And divorced characters.
Yeah.
But writing about what you know is the way to get to insight and truth.
That for me, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some people who make terrific movies, and clearly they're not writing from their own experience.
I read an interview. I read a review, and it called you prolific.
I know. I just read that.
Yeah. And I thought about that, and I would say industrious.
Prolific, I'd say, you know, lazy ass. I couldn't believe they said prolific. In 22 years, I've made 6 films. How could that be prolific? I should have like 11 films, I think.
Well, this is my question. If the funding was really easy, you got it whenever you wanted, how many films do you think
same.
You would have?
It would be the same.
It would be the same.
Yeah.
So it's not a funding question. It's mm-hmm. a... What's I'm not going to say slows because I've made 0 movies, but what
the hell am I doing?
What takes 4 years to make a movie or 5 years?
I don't know, man. Time goes by so fast. There was a movie I was going to direct.
Yeah.
2 years ago, so it wouldn't have been as big a thing, and I didn't end up directing it. But I got very, very close, so that took a year out of my life. I've been writing this script for, I mean, not 4 years, but a bunch of months. I've directed TV shows and a TV pilot. I've, you know, sent my kids off to college, you know, 3 years ago. Like, life.
Yeah. I don't mean, what the heck's wrong with you? What I mean is, again, back with Walking and Talking, I think I read that you were ready to go with that maybe 4 or 5 years before it actually went.
Yes.
But there was also a lot of iterations to that movie, and you kept working on it. Mm-hmm. Does that still go on? Do you keep working on these movies? And maybe do they get better because they take a while to germinate or marinate?
Probably. I mean, I hope to God I would never have to wait 5 or 6 years to get a movie financed that I have to rewrite it so much. I mean, you know, I was single when I wrote it and then married and, like, pregnant. Not pregnant yet, but when we shot it. It always takes a long time to get something set up, no matter what. It's not like, okay, we're in pre-production. So I always have time to work on it. But I haven't – there's no scripts that I want to make that I wasn't able to make.
Right.
Which is great. I just don't have inspiration frequently for an idea. And I keep looking for one or asking, you know, what do I want to write about? What do I want? And eventually something will click and last longer than a day. And then I write it. But they're infrequent.
And my last question is, there's one great line of dialogue by Connie Britton's character, who was an invention of yours, right?
Yes.
That wasn't in the book.
Right.
She talks about a problem she had with her ex chewing. What was the problem? He chewed. I have to say that goes on in my relationship. Where did that come from?
That's me.
Yeah? You have the problem with the person chewing?
I can't, like, nobody, if I'm on the phone with somebody and they're chewing, I swear I'm going to gag. And everybody who's in my life and knows me really well will not eat while we're talking on the phone.
There's a condition, you know.
I know.
Yeah.
I have it. I don't have it where I can't go to a restaurant or eat meals with people. That would be awful. Some people have that bad. You have it?
No, other way around. My girlfriend has it based on my chewing.
Your disgusting chewing?
Just the fact that I'm chewing.
That you're chewing. You gotta have smoothies.
Right. I'll take a liquid diet. Yeah. Just give me the IV. I will blow the whistle on myself and say, I can chew less loudly than other times. But there's some, you know, mastication causes some amount of
noise.
Yeah, disturbing of sound waves, and it happens.
Yeah.
By the way, so does it, by the way, strike you as, like, disgusting or on a different level? Like a weird, skin-crawly, nails on a chalkboard?
It's more that.
Yeah.
Yeah, on the phone especially.
What about in an audio report if you heard someone kind of chewing as they talk or chewing into a microphone?
There's so many, like, report journalists on the radio that I cannot listen to. The clicking.
Yeah.
And the lip, like, if their mouth is really dry like mine is right now. And, yeah, no, it really bugs me. I can't – I've turned off radio shows because of it. You're doing good, though. I don't hear anything from
you. I'm going to end now, just in case I click and clack.
Okay, good.
Pre-clicking and clacking. Nicole Holofcener's newest movie is The Land of Steady Habits. It's on Netflix. Great to meet you, Nicole.
Thank you. You too.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. Julie Swetnick has become the third woman to come forward to accuse Brett Kavanaugh of misdeeds. Well, misdeeds is downplaying the story she's telling. Multiple gang rapes among well-heeled D.C. teens that Kavanaugh was a part of and that she was the victim of. Her lawyer, the ubiquitous mongoose to Donald Trump's cobra, Michael Avenatti, put forward what he said was a sworn statement attesting to multiple gang rapes. Vanity Fair reporter Gabriel Sherman tweeted, "White House shocked by Avenatti claims. Privately, aides involved in nominations saying, quote, this could be the end of the line for Kavanaugh per outside advisors briefed on discussions." Really? You think? End of the line? Multiple gang rapes? These claims are so incredible that they just might be incredible. If they are true, I wonder what those repeated brags of the six FBI investigations could possibly mean. Let's note this, though. The new accusations are different in type from Christine Blasey Ford's story, which are different from the story told by the second accuser, Deborah Ramirez. Blasey Ford's were given extra credibility because, and I talked about this on the show, they didn't bear the hallmarks of a false report. There were no over-the-top details. There were no dramatic scenes. And also, the crime alleged wasn't as severe as it could have been. The latest accusations have all of those elements, don't they? Now, of course, all the claims, all of them, all the accusers could be saying things that absolutely happened that are absolutely true. It's also true that none of the accusers, none of the claims could be true. And it's also true that Blasey Ford's could be true. Julie Swetnick's might not be true. Deborah Ramirez's could be true or not be true. You could have a grab bag. Now, the last possibility that some claims are true, but some aren't, that has been pretty much dismissed by conservative supporters of Kavanaugh. Before the Swetnick accusations came out, conservatives were pointing to the second accuser's accusation as casting doubt on the first's. Here's Ross Douthat on the New York Times podcast, The Daily, assessing conservative thought and assessing that the reports of a second accuser have convinced many conservatives that Kavanaugh is guiltless.
So Ronan Farrow and Jane Meyer published this piece in The New Yorker where a woman came forward saying that Kavanaugh had exposed himself to her during a drunken game that involved dildos or sex toys during freshman year at Yale. And what's interesting is that I think this camp has been strengthened and has grown because I think a lot of conservatives looked at that reporting and thought it was unconvincing, shoddy, and seemed more obviously sort of ginned up by a search for a second allegation. And so they're reacting to that by essentially hardening their position, by saying this looks more like a witch hunt.
So it was the second allegation about Kavanaugh's time at Yale that hardened the position of conservatives, the position that Brett Kavanaugh didn't commit sexual assault before he got to Yale. Or maybe the hardening of that position actually predated the second accusation. Because here's John Podhoretz of Commentary Magazine in a podcast from last Thursday saying that Christine Blasey Ford's bargaining over the circumstances of her testimony, that's what really rallied conservatives.
And her refusal apparently to not only to cooperate with that idea or to appear, but to answer any questions posed to her by anybody except the FBI seems to have stiffened Republican spines in support of Kavanaugh and the idea that there's something untoward going on here and they should vote. If she's not going to appear, they should just vote and be done with it.
Within conservative media, I have heard numerous expressions of the tide having shifted back to Kavanaugh. Spines are stiffening. But this is at the same time that the polls show a different story. Now, it is true, the polls trail public opinion. But a Morning Consult poll, which was conducted from last Thursday through the weekend, so beginning at the exact time that John Podhoretz was talking about a stiffening of the Republican spine. It showed that while 68% of Republican men wanted Kavanaugh confirmed, support among Republican women had fallen to just 48%. Still, the National Review ran an article today saying that the second accusation, because it was acknowledged to be a hazy memory, a memory formed while drunk, quote, could destroy the Me Too movement. I'll read a quote. Sunday night, Farrow and his colleague Jane Mayer did a huge disservice to the Me Too movement by publishing an incredibly thin sexual abuse allegation against Brett Kavanaugh. So what must they think of Michael Avenatti's new client? Let's just point out that even if this new allegation doesn't hold water, it really says nothing about what Christine Blasey Ford alleged. And I have a good example that actually bears this out. Early on in this saga, the conservative writer Ed Whelan floated a theory that it wasn't Kavanaugh who assaulted Blasey Ford in high school. It was another boy. Whelan went ahead and named him, and that story totally blew up. It was discredited. Whelan retracted. He apologized. But should we look at that? Should we look at an alibi that turned out to be no alibi at all? Should we look at an argument in defense of Kavanaugh blowing up as discrediting all defenses of Kavanaugh? Does that mean there can be no argument in defense of Kavanaugh just because this one argument went nowhere? I don't think Kavanaugh's defenders would say that. And yet they are saying that an accusation that turns out not to be true, if indeed it turns out not to be true, that should discredit all accusations. So if you hear anyone on the right talking about witch hunts or patterns of false charges, remember, you could turn that around to whitewashing and patterns of false alibis. So are we any further down the road in assessing Kavanaugh's guilt or innocence in this matter? I think not. But I would also caution us all to doubt partisans who argue that at this moment, the tides have turned or the spines have stiffened. That's it for today's show. Pierre Bien-Aimé and Daniel Schrader produced The Gist. The Netflix film about them, based on a state motto, is Famous Potatoes. TJ Raphael is senior producer of Slate Podcast. Look for her in an upcoming one-woman show, Utah, where ideas connect. Steve Lickteig is executive producer of Slate Podcasts. He comes from Kansas. Kansas wants you to know, Kansas, it's as big as you think. That's the actual Kansas slogan, which contrasts with Nebraska's slogan, Kansas, no one's thinking about you as much as you think. The Gist, fresh air and fond memories served daily. It is the slogan of Colorado, but it also applies to this podcast. Well, Terry Gross already called dibs. God damn it. Upuru deperu duperu. And thanks for listening.